I think when you're in a busy private practice trying to see patients and take care of stuff routinely, and that's across the spectrum for primary care provider, rheumatologist, physiatrist, everybody, we're all busy. We have lots of patients we're taking care of, and to be able to at least quickly handle a source of pain, and especially if that helps the patient ultimately improve and return back to normal function.
Welcome to the HAP-MNR Journal Club, a podcast where we introduce you to thought leaders who are published in the American Journal of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. This is a show about practices, research, and education that are shaping the field of physiatry in inspiring ways. The Journal Club is brought to you by the Association of Academic Physiatrists, or AAP, an intimate and influential professional society that brings together leading minds at every career level. Physiatrists and professors, directors and med students, researchers and residents, this is your behind-the-scenes look at people and ideas that will influence your future. Your host is Dr. Eric Wysocki, an AAP member with Georgetown University School of Medicine.
Hello, this is your podcast host, Dr. Eric Wysocki from the MedStar National Rehabilitation Hospital. I'm joined by my co-host for the day, outstanding PGY2 resident, Dr. Matthew Kelly.
Good morning. Happy to be here with you this morning.
We are fortunate to be joined today by our special guest, Dr. Matthew Carroll. Dr. Carroll is a rheumatologist currently working at the Singing River Health System. He is also a retired colonel from the United States Air Force. So thank you for your service, Dr. Carroll, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for yours, and thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Wonderful. We're very excited to talk to you about your very interesting article that is about to be published in the June 2018 edition of the American Journal of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. The article is titled, Comparing Corticosteroid Preparation and Dose in the Improvement of Shoulder Function and Pain, a Randomized Single-Blind Pilot Study. So we really applaud you for this work, and we were hoping we could start, Dr. Carroll, by you giving us kind of a brief summary of your work.
Yeah, so as a clinically active rheumatologist, and then prior to me starting my fellowship as a when I was an internist, shoulder injections and relief of shoulder pain have always been of interest to me. Obviously, we see across the spectrum from primary care to rheumatology to physiatrist, everybody, we see a lot of shoulder pain. And usually some degree of subacromial bursitis seems to play into that picture. And I always remember being taught from my senior staff years ago that, you know, you had your flavor of different steroids that you could kind of inject, but there really didn't seem to be, at least at the time, that much evidence to suggest what dose, how much, what preparation really makes that much of a difference. So my colleagues and I at Kiesler Medical Center, which is where I worked prior to my retirement, undertook this study trying to take a look at what dose and preparation really seemed to maybe have a potential distinction to help relieve shoulder pain. And really more appropriate for us is we wanted to focus on the actual improvement in function. Pain seems to be hit and miss sometimes, but the function actually would be more important to us. And so we used the Quick Dash as a validated instrument of upper arm function to take a look and see how varying doses and randomizing subjects between triamcinolone and methylprednisolone, 20 milligrams or 40 milligrams for a one-time injection, would actually have an effect. We kind of recorded data over the course of a six-week period to eventually see what was the durability of that improvement in Quick Dash performance. And so essentially all of our subjects that we randomized, it's not a terribly large study, but a decent subject cohort of 62 patients. We were able to randomize them successfully and at least keep them equally matched across age, gender, ethnicity, and the sites injected. And at 6 weeks, we didn't observe any statistically significant difference, at least in the improvement in Quick Dash, comparing the different doses and preparations of the glucocorticoids. No differences in adverse effects were noted either. So I think it shows potentially, and of course, you know, there's different limitations of this study as well as strengths, but it would appear that we need to probably have continued research, but there doesn't seem to at least be any immediate or obvious benefit from choosing a higher or lower dose or a different preparation of a glucocorticoid for your shoulder pain bursitis subjects.
This is really, really interesting findings. You know, as someone working in academic medicine and someone who has to teach residents how to do these injection procedures, you know, they often ask questions about, you know, what dosing should I use, which medication. And oftentimes as someone teaching, it feels like there's a fairly voodoo nature sometimes to this decision making. Was that at all an inspiration for you doing this work?
It was. I like the voodoo reference. It seems to be a lot of what your staff knew and were taught, and then they seem to propagate that going forward, which if it works, I guess is fine. But we live in the era of evidence-based medicine, certainly, and it's always good to try to generate information to see what does it really make that much of a difference. So, yeah, we're trying to do a little bit of dispelling of the voodoo, and I guess we just figured after our research before we started the trial 2-3 years ago, it seemed appropriate to just start at least with comparing methylprednisolone to triamcinolone. That was kind of our start point.
Outstanding.
Morning, Dr. Carroll.
Morning.
We were happy to see as physiatrists that you used the quick dash and had a strong focus on function rather than just pain. And while there were no statistically significant decreases in or differences rather in the four arms of the study, the gross numbers did seem to lean towards slightly more favorable outcomes in the 40 milligram dose group. So while statistically insignificant, and we often see it with our folks coming into clinic, and they pose the question that if you were to have the injection performed on you or a loved one yourself, would you have any preference regarding injectate or concentration?
That's a hard question. It's an excellent question, but it's a hard question to answer. I think on first blush, you know, I would want to say, no, I'd go for the 20 milligram dose, but I think if I had severe pain, and I've had episodes of bursitis in the past, never injected. Thankfully, they've lasted a week or two and then spontaneously resolved with some exercises, but my thought would probably be to go for the higher dose. So I guess just to be honest, although the data doesn't support it, but maybe that's, again, the voodoo that seems to play into it.
Appreciate that personal perspective. I was hoping you could comment a little bit about the time points you used to follow your patients over time. It seemed at 6 weeks, the results were similar between the two groups. Did you think at all about maybe following them out even further, to potentially see, how long-lasting the benefits of these injections could be?
We did. So we had a little bit of a struggle trying to figure out the exact timing and frequency at which to collect the data for the quick dash. We did a trial several years ago where we actually randomized patients between a glucocorticoid intrabursal injection to an IL-1 trap called rilonacept. The physiology seems to suggest that interleukin-1 is a fairly prominent cytokine, at least early on in the bursitis process. So we did a 2-day, 2-week follow-up period. And then 4 week. And we reached the outcome we wanted to, but we felt that was probably too tight of an interval. So then we figured when we went forward and designed this trial a year or two later, that we would actually try to space out the interval a little bit more to the 3-day, 3-week, and 6-week. The literature seems to be kind of all over the place with the different time points that you may or may not want to collect data for pain and or function. We did think about potentially even going out as far as 12 weeks, but we figured at least with the data that we had and what we were seeing in the literature and from our previous research that perhaps it was worth at least just trying to go out to 6 weeks and then maybe design a bigger trial later if that's where we wanted to go.
That makes perfect sense. Thank you.
Shifting gears a little bit, Dr. Carroll, in your methods, you noted that in an effort to simulate kind of routine clinical settings, the decision was made to perform all of these injections blindly using anatomic landmarks rather than musculoskeletal ultrasound. I know you referenced a 2016 trial, which had shown no real difference in pain or function scores for that matter, given ultrasound-guided versus blind subacromial injections for impingement syndrome. There's been some other prior meta-analysis, including by Dr. Wu back in 2015, which have contradicted this somewhat. Do you think with your study having a relatively modest sample size, being able to verify needle placement would have strengthened your findings at all?
Yeah, we struggle with that question too because none of the investigators in this study have ultrasound experience, but we're all active clinicians. And we know that ultrasound is certainly becoming more to the forefront to assist us in a variety of different, ways across the spectrum from primary care to certainly rheumatology. It's obviously very big in rheumatology, but we figured we'd try to keep it as clinically centric as possible, which there's still a lot of clinicians out there that are not trained on ultrasound. And the ultrasound can sometimes slow down a busy clinic day, so depending on how versatile you are with it. So for us, we decided that we would just try to stay as focused with the clinical aspect, and that did entail the potential risk that maybe we weren't truly in the bursa. We tried pretty much to do at least a posterior lateral approach, which seems pretty consistent with our experiences over the course of 10 to 20 years of practice of at least hitting the area that's going to be the target pretty much, even blind. So we did wrestle with it. We figured in the end we would try to stay at least the clinic-centric side of it, perhaps later in a future trial build an ultrasound depending on our expertise and how future data were obtained.
As a quick follow-up, as you alluded to, kind of with that growing exposure and the growing interest in musculoskeletal ultrasound, especially within physiatry, do you think we're going to start to see a shift, or have you already seen a shift with more physicians and patients preferring to perform these under ultrasound guidance, or do you think that time factor and experience is going to get in the way of the more traditional?
Yeah, so good, excellent question. I think having come from an academic environment at Keesler where we had a residency to now a private practice environment, the academic arena seems a little bit more focused on ultrasound and teaching that skill set, which is certainly very valuable, but it's ironic, kind of on the outside now in private practice. It seems harder to justify that skill set because it's not always as, I guess, cash revenue generating, probably, unless you're, again, really, really experienced with it. So perhaps the slant I would have, or my explanation of the question, would be that it seems like in academic environments you're more likely to see that happening, and maybe that will be the trend. Perhaps 20 to 40 years from now, ultrasound will be kind of like our stethoscopes. You know, you'll just have it with you all the time, especially as they become more portable and the information you're getting is a lot easier to obtain. I think when you're in a busy private practice trying to see patients and take care of stuff routinely, and that's across the spectrum for primary care provider, rheumatologist, physiatrist, everybody, we're all busy. We have lots of patients we're taking care of, and to be able to at least quickly handle a source of pain, and especially if that helps the patient ultimately improve and return back to normal function, you know, I think it's going to be unclear about where ultrasound fits into that paradigm.
Certainly, as some of the technology and ease of use, and probably other
things. Yeah, it's amazing the stuff I'm seeing. Yeah, with the little probes through your iPhone now, that's crazy. Yeah. It's amazing. But maybe again, 10, 15 years from now, it'll be everybody's doing ultrasound because it's so easy to do. It's just, I think reimbursement is an issue on the private practice side, and so if it's going to cost you 20 minutes to do it, whereas you could just done the injection blind, you're more, at least I know I'm more inclined to just do the injection and move on.
Yeah, Dr. Carroll, I really appreciate that kind of real-world perspective on ultrasound use. You know, it's such a hot topic in our field, and you know, a huge focus of education at our conferences. So much so that it almost makes people feel that it's become the standard of care and everyone's using it. But I really appreciate getting your perspective on some of the challenges of implementation, which I certainly understand. One thing I wanted to ask you about was the timing of conservative care prior to injection. I know in your inclusion criteria, it was required that patients needed to have at least 2 weeks of conservative care prior to injection. One thing I wasn't clear on from your article was, you know, maybe the average amount of time of conservative care in the patients in your study, and just want to pose a question in that regard, was you know, whether or not 2 weeks of conservative care is adequate prior to considering injection, or if, you know, perhaps we may want to consider giving patients even more time with physical therapy or exercises prior to performing an injection.
Yeah, that was another question, much like the time point dilemma about trying to figure out when to actually measure function and pain improvements. We had a hard time figuring out, like, how long do you wait before you get somebody into a bursitis trial? And again, speaking from my own personal experience, having had shoulder bursitis in the past, I was thankful that it went away after a week or two. But there was a point where I was almost thinking about getting it injected, and then it started to improve. And so perhaps maybe the two-week period is too short. For the most part, a lot of the patients, this was not included in the article, but for the vast majority of patients who were randomized in this trial, they certainly had at least 2 weeks of pain persistence, and that was not improving with at least conservative therapies, over-the-counter anti-inflammatories, some self-guided exercises at home, no formal physical. I mean, maybe a few had some physical therapy. I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it was certainly a minority. So the reality is, yeah, could we have waited longer than 2 weeks? That's not an unreasonable question to ask. It's unclear about how long to wait before you say, okay, they've failed conservative therapies to move on. 4 weeks might be a better time estimate. But most of the patients at least had a solid 2 weeks of pain without improvement.
Shifting to some of the implications of the study, generally, in my limited experience so far, I don't see a joint being injected more than three times in a year at the same site. That can vary, obviously, depending on some provider preference. But if we're talking about potentially using lower dosage injections, which are just as efficacious, would you be more prone to recommending more frequent repeat injections, knowing that we're using these lower dosages?
You know, the challenge there is that it would be enticing to think that that would be perhaps a strategy going forward, that if you're using lower doses, you might be able to get away with a little bit more. I think regardless, I don't know if we know the threshold effect for it yet, where that is, if it's 10 milligrams or 5 milligrams or 80 milligrams, you know, what's the threshold effect for thinking about cartilaginous toxicity, like what's the chondrotoxic level? So the long and short of it is I don't think really that's known. And so maybe lower, more frequent dosing could be better, but we don't know if that would still accelerate cartilaginous damage. That aside, and certainly I know that's a little bit of a tangent from the burst. The burst is different, but let's assume that there's the same kind of pathophysiologic effect occurring when you're injecting routine steroids on a regular basis. That debate will be settled in the future, or may not, who knows when that'll be figured out. Probably more germane, and especially from a clinical practice standpoint, if you've injected somebody's shoulder two or three times and they're kind of improving and then they fail again, it's probably time for you to consider either more advanced imaging, such as with an MRI, to make sure you certainly have the right structure, but maybe even there at that point, time for them to see orthopedics. So I know for me in my practice, I'll do one or two injections with physical therapy down the road if they don't improve to the first one and they need a repeat. And if after I've done as much of the conservative stuff that I can do, either with anti-inflammatories, topical or oral injections, physical therapy, it's probably time that we at least consider, whether or not to be covered is a different story, but maybe consider MRI of the shoulder or even just directly referring them to orthopedic, saying, I've done as much as I can. Is this a patient that may be a candidate for subacromial bursal decompression?
Thank you, Dr. Carroll. So that's all of our questions for today. I think that certainly your work here gives clinicians a lot of food for thought on how to proceed with our patient care in terms of injections. So I certainly really appreciate it. Did you have any last words that you wanted to say about your work here?
No, I really appreciate the opportunity to be on this podcast today. Thank you for this time. I think the trials, like everything else, you think answer a question and then you generate more questions afterwards. So I hope that this fuels future trials going forward. I know for us, we'd like to try to get back on that saddle and develop a study with longer endpoints following patients out further and see what's really the best modality and dosage and all that stuff to hopefully answer some of these questions. Like I said, I know it's been an area of interest of mine, but I hope this will generate others out there to consider asking those same questions and continuing to blaze that trail to figure out where to go.
Perfectly said. Again, we really appreciate you joining us, Dr. Matthew Carroll from Singing River Health System. Please check out his article in the upcoming June 2018 edition of American Journal of Physical Medicine Rehab entitled Comparing Corticosteroid Preparation and Dose in the Improvement of Shoulder Function and Pain. Again, I am Dr. Eric Wasotsky from MedStar National Rehabilitation Hospital. I was joined today by my co-host, PGY2 resident, Dr. Matthew Kelly. Please join us for the next AAP American Journal of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation podcast. Thank you very much.